Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast, where we bring together tech leaders from all across the globe to share their time, their insights, and their expertise to help you grow and I grow in businesses. My name is Gary Lafty. I am the host of your show and the CEO of Growth Focus Partnerships, where we take and elevate experts in their field and make them authorities so that they stand out above all the noise. They turn their conversations into clients and their expertise into... I can't wait for this particular episode. This episode, we're going to be talking about how do you bootstrap a company in a VC-led world? What is it going to take for you to grow that business if you don't want to go down the VC route? We're going to be talking about how thought leadership as a growth mechanism in a tech company today, and also what doesn't work when it comes to growing your business, when it comes to growth, what doesn't work so we can avoid those landmines so that you can just do what needs to be done to grow. So without further ado, I can't wait to get started. Dennis, let's bring you on board. It's great to actually have you here. Looking forward to this one without a shadow of a doubt. Why don't you start off by introducing yourself, telling us who you are and what is it that you actually do?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Gary. My name is Dennis Underwood, if you didn't get that already. And I'm here in the United States in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And honestly, you know, I always joke that my career has been spent, attacking windmills instead of going around them, you know? And so I'm really good at inventing things, mostly in the world of cybersecurity, actually, and developing products. I'm a huge fan of automation. Of course, you know, with AI, everyone's talking about automation now, so it's easier to have that conversation. But that's kind of always been my theme in the last 20, 25 years of being a business.
Well, you know, I can't wait to delve deeper into this with you, Dennis, on this episode. But as always, let's get to know you a little bit. Let's start at the very beginning. How did your journey start as a founder, and what originally drew you into cybersecurity?
That's a great question. So when I started, it actually wasn't, you know, so some people have this like post-MBA aha moment or something like that, right? And really what happened was that I'm from Pittsburgh, and in, I'll say, the late 90s, early 2000s, there was an economic downturn, and a whole bunch of old guys, you know, like my age now, no, I'm the old guy, right? But like, you know, companies were trying to hire more junior IT positions, and I was trying to get my break and get started. And these other guys were, you know, and women were interviewing for the same jobs I was trying to get, right? And so what happened was I was being told no a couple times. And then one day I just turned around and I said, well, what if I come back as Dennis Underwood LLC, Dennis Underwood Incorporated, you know, just my own company. And of course, the recruiter and the office manager and the managers loved that idea because they could get me cheap. They could fire me as soon as the project was done. No benefits, no pension, you know, like, and I was like, well, I don't need any of that stuff. I'm just, you know, 21 or whatever, you know. And so that's actually how the founder story started, was I just spun back around and said, what if I come on as a consultant, basically? And it just kind of kept growing from there, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a funny how some we have to reinvent ourselves, or we are the same person, but we have to be seen as something else in order to take the next step. And I always love those pivots. So talking about pivots, you're on your third company now. What has been some of those pivotal lessons at Dennis from building each one to today?
Yeah, that's great. So, I mean, the first one really was all about just IT services. And as I was kind of coming to a close, I was in the Army. They call it the Army National Guard, for helping to pay for school. There's a lot more money now than there was when I was there, which is good for the students, I guess. But, you know, I left for Iraq for Operation Rocky Freedom, and I came back. And of course, when you have a services business, if you're gone, the clients just dry up, right? Or they just go ahead and hire the consultants you had working for you, you know, and that's all fair. And by then I had realized that I was a lot better at finding gaps in the user's manual than actually knowing what to do on page 53 of the Active Directory user's manual, for instance, you know. And so what happened was that I actually went ahead and I said, well, you know what, let me try some security stuff out. And it turns out that cybersecurity is born out of people doing things that the original inventors never really wanted them to do, right? Like, they were finding things outside the user manual, which is perfect. And so I started doing on my second company. I was down in Charlotte, actually, at the time. I started doing more security work to be able to, you know, reinvent myself around security, right? And then do more work that more was aligned towards myself and what I was good at and what I could help people to be good at, which really was try this thing that we haven't tried before. You know? So that's really what happened. The shift of product actually was because I, you know, when when you're in an industry that is simply inundated with too much work, and you're a cost center, so there is an upper limit to what any customer would pay for you, you need to either, you know, find some hidden country just full of people you can bring on board very cheaply, or you start automating and multiplying your efficiency. In the military, we call it force multipliers, right? And so I realized very quickly, you know, even having my security, my security company, I said, you know what, there has to be a way that we have to automate ourselves and enhance our productivity to fit into the mold of what companies need. And anyone who can do that is a winner. That did lead me to NSA for a while. So I kind of took a little bit of a trip into the military and intelligence community. But really, it was all still the same theme. How can we make one person have the productivity of five, which isn't a cybersecurity problem, right? That's just generic industrial revolution, you know, from the start, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the key thing. And I said it, and it's so refreshing to hear. And I'm always interested in talking to founders like you who do these major pivots or sometimes just find themselves in an industry and just think, well, how can we make the best out of it? So for people who don't know what you do today, why don't you tell us a little bit about the problem that you solve and who you solve it for?
Absolutely. Yeah. So in 2020, right in January, I actually pivoted the company. We moved away from all of the product development for the military. I pivoted the company there. I was always looking for an opportunity and I found it. There's essentially two markets in cybersecurity. There's like the hacker market, you know, and then there is the, the vendor market, you know, for defenders all trying to keep our data and our identity safe. And what I had seen, you know, was that the market was really ripe for both on the hacker side and on the vendor side, on the defense side, for a product that was fully automated that would stop something that was very visible in cybersecurity, which is ransomware, and that I could build something around being able to take action so decisively and so preventatively that no damage would be done. Harder to do back when data breaches were just the way things were done, because of course, you know, if data was stolen, well, guess what? The cashiers are still able to process your purchase of bread for the week. Business remained uninterrupted. And suddenly I said, you know what? Ransomware really is a CFO, COO, and VP of sales problem, not just for the CIO, the tech guys to deal with later on. So I chased that. And lo and behold, we found the right combination of inventions to make it work. And we've it's been a good journey so far. I look forward to seeing what's coming next year.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think very exciting times ahead. And it's one of those industries which is inevitably always going to grow. It's just when you, there's always going to be risk. And as soon as you can block one, it's like a hole in the bucket. As soon as you block one hole, there's going to be another hole. It just continues to go. So with that being said, there is continuous growth. You've done very well within your companies. When it comes to growing your company, what has worked really well? What is working with you now in the lead generation, getting clients arena?
Yeah, you know what? I did try early on. You mentioned in the beginning of this session, you know, bootstrapping in a VC-dominated world that is sometimes very well-funded with a lot of noise, right? If there is an industry that has a lot of noise, it's definitely cybersecurity. You know, I don't know all of them, but cybersecurity is definitely one with a lot of noise. I always morbidly joke that if we were all bridge builders, that there'd be a lot of bridges in the rivers, you know, because, you know, they're not made correctly, right? You know, the thing that I learned quickly was I got into a bidding war with some of our incumbents, you know, like a CrowdStrike or a SentinelOne or whatever for ad spend, actually, for getting, you know, eyeballs and clicks. And I was in this like bidding war with a $1 billion company. And of course, whenever that happens, you lose, right? You know, so I made it up to about $1,000 a click. They were all exhausted within the first 5 minutes of the day. And I realized that, you know, I'm not going to be able to spend my way to get more attention for people from prospects. So I did a lot of investigating and realized that LinkedIn was a great place for me to go. Now it's less of a great place now because of like AI bots and things like that. But what happened was I realized that when I interviewed some of the people that did say hi to me, they really liked LinkedIn social media because they could control the pace of the conversation with any prospect or vendor, and they were able to turn you off, you know, whenever they wanted, and then get back to you a month later. And you could be rude about it, I guess, and have them never come back, or you just realize that they like having that being the driver's seat of that vendor prospect kind of communication, that relationship. So they like that a lot. And then I realized also, I put out a couple thought leadership posts, And I realized that the thought leadership posts were getting a lot more attention, if not interaction, but at least people saw it and they mentioned it. And I was getting the attention there. Not so much on the commercial like posts or, you know, hey, buy my product kind of stuff. So I realized it was really working when from a growth strategy, once people started saying they've heard of me, but they couldn't quite place where, or they had seen something I had talked about and they were trying to figure out what conference I was at, they were at or whatever. And I was like, no conference, you know, that was all LinkedIn posts, right? So I realized that that's a great place to build. And, you know, right now I think I have like 16,000 followers. It's all built organically. I don't pay for followers or anything like that. I don't think that's a good sales strategy. And, you know, that's really what's worked. I did try Facebook. Our product's not the right product for Facebook, you know, but for LinkedIn, it's really worked out well. And people are responding when we call them if they've seen our marketing quite a bit and they realize that we're serious people that, you know, are trying to do good things. And then they'll answer the phone in a way they probably wouldn't have earlier.
No, I think this is a key thing when it comes down to, there'll be people listening here and watching this particular episode, but I can almost see them there. They're nodding their head and said, we've tried those Google ads because that's what Marketing 101 tells us to do. That's what we do, that, and we're changing it, but it just didn't work. And I think before we break down everything you just said there, I think it's worthwhile to go back and just say, look, why it didn't work. And I think you explained it very well. And I want to dive a little bit further into that. There's always going to be people with deeper pockets. And this is the key thing. It's not necessarily the ad. And I want people to understand this. When it comes to using Google Ads, it's not the ad that's usually the challenge. It is the incumbents are out there, the billion-dollar incumbents. What was it that made you realize, and how quickly did it make you realize that actually we're getting outbid here all the time, you know? And it's not really my ad. It's the fact that it could be the best ad on earth. I just don't have the pockets these guys have got.
Right. So, you know, as a founder, you know, I joke about, you know, inflating windmills. But as a founder, that's pretty much what you're doing every time you're doing something, right? You know, unless there's some scheme or scam, you're really going up against changing people's behaviors, right? Against folks that probably have already been making money doing whatever that you want to do, right? And so, you know, I tried a variety of strategies to try to work around that. I tried micro-targeting, all the same tools available to everyone, of course, you know, but I tried micro-targeting. I tried changing the times and having like 15-minute blocks of time, hoping maybe that the other folks wouldn't have the ad spot reserved then. I tried different platforms, actually. So I moved around. I just did due diligence. Then I got to the point where I was using keywords that were less obvious, and I realized I was being chased because I would see the cost per click go up from, you know, already like $20 or something, you know, whatever it was, I forget. And then just, it started scaling exponentially very quickly. And then I realized that no matter what I did, I was battling, you know, some automation that would consume my budget within about 5-10 minutes. Right? And there are some technologies a little bit that kind of work against that. But, you know, I wish I could say I learned very quickly, but it was over about like maybe a 60-day period that I realized that, you know, I couldn't afford, you know, $5,000 worth of clicks that only really lasted about 10 minutes. And at best, I was getting like, you know, Luke Skywalker at protonmail.com kind of stuff. Like, I wasn't getting real leads, you know? So I realized that, I exhausted all reasonable measures, you know, and realized that there's absolutely not going to be a solution here using this method. And so what do? You find other avenues, you know, right away. You pivot. And I think that's the biggest blessing for founders, especially for bootstrap ones, you know, is that you're not locked into, maybe you have like a dogmatic VC or something like that. You know, not that I speak from experience, but, you know, they have, you agree to this business plan, you must keep going, you know, or else, you know. And as a founder, I said, well, I'm only answering to my employees at that point and my families and their families. So really it comes down to, you know, what can I do right by everyone involved? And that required pivoting the entire marketing strategy over from, you know, 5-second ads or whatever I was doing to this organic outreach, which took a while. It was not immediate, right?
So let's talk a little bit about that, because this is the key thing. I doubt there's anybody listening or watching that doesn't use LinkedIn, but I'm going to use that word use LinkedIn very, very loosely here, because LinkedIn is fantastic. Other people say it doesn't work, and I think it's just like everything else. If done right, it works really, really well. If it's done wrong, well, you mentioned thought leadership, which we're going to come back to, but also the fact that once somebody's engaged with them, you are now out trying them, you're calling them, you're approaching them, you're actually talking to them and using it like a lead generation from people who like you. So, but let's go back to this thought leadership thing. Thought leadership is very much of an, in my opinion, and my experience, overused. It's an overused term. Lots of people say they do thought leadership stuff, but really, it isn't. It's glorified adverts. And, you know, you just see it like you just mentioned earlier. It's just people peddling stuff, right? There's a, here's my solution to this. Here's my solution to that, blah, blah. There's no real thought leadership. Thought leadership, in my opinion, is when someone goes, didn't think of that. That's a really good point. That is thought leadership. Can you give us an example of what you classify as thought leadership and why it's worked so well for you?
Yeah. So, you know, with all of the ChatGPT stuff coming out, it's actually only, it's given me a good litmus test of what not to do. It's interesting. If everybody is saying one thing and you feel strongly enough that you can prove a case and educate them so that eventually they come along to your way of thinking, then for me, that's thought leadership, is to educate them enough that they start to think more your way, which of course is the way that you've probably built your product or your service. And so it is much more of an education, a professorial approach. It is definitely long term. Like, it is not something that no one's going to say, aha, you know, and then suddenly they're lining up for your product or service. But with ChatGPT, you know, I tried using some of the ghostwriting services. You won't see any ghostwriting on any of our materials, right? But in the background, I was trying different people and I realized they were all using ChatGPT no matter where I went. And the thing about ChatGPT is it's an amalgamation of everything everybody else is saying already, right? So there's no leadership. You're just in the middle of the pack, right? Which is a very safe place to be. Good unless you're trying to sell something. I mean, good if you're like maybe a student and you just want to blend in and get that B or whatever, you know? But if you're trying to be one degree removed or separated, you know, or a little bit ahead, hopefully, of what everyone else is saying, then for me, ChatGPT almost became like a test, like a pH test for the pool or something, you know, where I'm like, okay, you know, if I'm blending in too much with what everybody else is saying, and ChatGPT is agreeing with me a little too much, that I need to push myself and go a little bit farther because I need to lead the pack, not just be in the middle of it, right? And so that's actually what I consider thought leadership, is to be a little bit different, challenge people's perceptions, and educate them and lead them towards where you want them to be mentally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, Dennis, you know, this, again, it makes common sense, but common sense isn't common practice. We say this all the time, that if you're trying to stand out above the noise, and I don't think I've ever spoken to anybody within the field that says, I'm not trying to stand out, right? Everyone's trying to stand out above the noise. And you, like you said earlier, cybersecurity is one of those very, very oversaturated, noisy environments to be in, let alone to work in and try and stand out. But you're right. If ChatGPT is the norm and you use ChatGPT for your posting to stand out, well, effectively, you're not. You're not going to stand out because you are just like everybody else. So not only is your marketing standing like everybody else, your posting is sounding, social media sounds like everybody else, and you're just caught in this quagmire of everybody sounding exactly the same thing. So absolutely, thought leadership, founder-led marketing is something that we're always pioneering here at Growth Partnerships, because that's what it's about. It's about growing your authority within the field as a founder. So let's talk about founder-led marketing. What role do you personally play, Dennis, in business development today?
Great question. The first is that I realized early on that I can speak with an authority on, you know, what I want to talk about, what I choose to talk about, that I can defend being the authority. So I can say things that are a lot more, you know, some people say, oh, you're just punching up or whatever, but I can say things with more authority and with more impact and more forcefully than maybe like some of my salespeople who maybe have to, you know, if we're playing good cop, bad cop, then I don't try to be a bad cop, but I can at least push the boundaries a little bit, you know, and make people uncomfortable because I need them to move. You know, I need them to get off of their inertia-led path to IBM or whatever they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. So with founder-led marketing, I do write all of my posts. If I feel especially challenged, sometimes I'll ask, hey, look this over. Is this going too far? Every now and then, you know, some of my people will call me and say, hey, that was great. Or, that maybe don't do that one. I actually deleted a post last night that they said, that resonates with your military experience, but that's not, most people are not going to appreciate that. So let's go ahead and put that one on the shelf, you know, and I'm like, okay, fair enough. You know, so that's the role I take. I take the cheerleader, the motivator to move people. I've been told by some, you know, we have some CISOs who are investors, and they're like, I can't post or like the things that you like. And I'm like, well, but you're seeing them. And that's the important part, is that, you know, you were moved to come speak to me about this, you know, like, and that really is, you know, that's the laws of thermodynamics that I'm motivated to affect. My sales folks, I always tell them, if they do an outreach, I always believe in transparency and integrity in sales. And I always believe that getting to the know as soon as possible in social media and online means to say exactly why you're calling. Don't beat around the bush. Don't pretend that because we're both humans, we have to just spend time talking to each other. Come out, try to add value right away. It's hard to do on 140 characters, but try to get to that no, because you have to tell them why you're reaching out. And so that's kind of marketing, that thought leadership is kind of bled down to the salespeople, even though they sometimes, that's not the right profession to kind of go out there and be a little bit abrasive sometimes. That's more of a power.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Getting to that no as quickly as possible, remove the no's. Because I think marketing is this, and this is something which, especially within our industry, most people aren't aware of, and that they assume that marketing is all about lead generation, is about just attracting your ideal clients. But marketing is also a degree of repelling those who aren't. If you do the right type of marketing, you're actually repelling those who you're not right for, they're not right for you, so that you can actually focus on those who are right for you, so that you can grow your company from there. And it was really interesting what you said there about earlier, when it comes to people liking or following, just because they're not liking it doesn't mean they're not moved by it. It doesn't mean they didn't read it, they didn't watch your post, they didn't save it mentally, that post that you actually had. And at the end of that, people are striving for these likes and whatnot. But sometimes there are people who are just watching. And your ideal client could be just sitting there waiting for that time that's right for them, but consuming it. And I think that's a good value point to actually make there. Yeah. And another case of founder-led marketing, and for people who are... Well, let me ask you this question then, Dennis. How important do you believe founder-led marketing is within the environment of growing a company within the tech industry today?
You know, I think not everyone is going to be able to do the founder-led marketing in the same way. You know, I meet people from all different walks, you know, who have different specialties and different things to say or not say if they're, you know, if that's just not them, right? And I think, though, that giving up the control over the message and, you know, deciding, I think, let me back up, that's my turn to back up right now, is to step back and say, okay, what kind of online persona do I want to give as the founder of this company? And then no matter if you end up having to outsource that or not, then I think you need to approve every message that goes out until you get a cadence. Maybe that means every 2 weeks you sit down, you just map out topics and you spend some time reading. Maybe that means that you're actually just dictating into, you know, your phone for an English arts major to, you know, pick apart and turn into proper English, you know, like, or whatever language, right? But it has to have the founder's eyes on that. And I think that having that, just like a business plan for me, product was very important, to have like something concrete, you know, that has to be reflected in the persona that you want the founder to represent, starting, even if it's like, you don't have like the company persona and like, it doesn't matter, because it has to start there. And it almost feels like that is worth more than all the billboards, all the flashiness. You know, I always say sometimes we're more of like Tony Stark versus the Justin Hammer. And the Hammers of the world, they always have their cheerleaders and their bikinis and their fireworks and dancing bears and whatever. You got to have your, you know, Tony Stark always had to have his presence, right? And so for me, I'm like, the founder very much has to tell that story, whatever that story is.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more there, Dennis, because ultimately what we believe and what we're seeing with great results is authenticity. It's the founder's authenticity, whether it be their voice, whether it be their words. They don't necessarily have to, because people in tech aren't really known for standing in front of a camera generally and being the outgoing one. It's not where they feel most comfortable. So it does take a special type of founder who's willing to do that and get in front of the camera all the time. But either way, like you just said, even if you're just putting down on paper and looking to make sure it's your voice, your authenticity, and it's actually how you would come across, because people do want to know about you. They want to know about your mission. They care about your mission more than you think they do, you know, and it's not necessarily caring in a personal way. They just want to know, why should I do business with you? What is it that makes you different, you know, if the product is the same, especially in cybersecurity or B2B SaaS or whatever the case may be. So that being said, let's talk a little bit about sales. How are you closing deals today in an environment where buyers are skeptical? It's really hard to earn trust. They're either overwhelmed or just basically resistant to change.
Yeah. I can only do so much as a bootstrapped company, right? I'm not going to be able to afford for the market analyst to come back with, you know, the right contract to then, you know, have the right placement on a quadrant or report. You just can't afford it. You know, and the people you're up against, you know, they'll spend $1 million for that in a heartbeat, right? And that good luck finding that $1 million and checking, right? So, you know, so for me, really getting out there and just being vulnerable seems to be the most effective strategy moving forward. It is the vulnerability, the transparency of just getting out there. I hope that answered the question. I don't know, I kind of went a different direction there.
Well, yeah, sort of talk about the vulnerability there. I love that vulnerability. And I'm a great believer, and people who have been watching this will know that, you know, when people are zigging, you've got to be zagging. You've got to be something totally different, right? You've got to just break the curve a little bit. But also that vulnerability goes back to authenticity is what I said earlier. And you said that when it comes to being that, what is your definition? Explain a little bit more about what you mean by that vulnerability.
Yeah. So when you don't have the opportunity to hide behind layers of PR handlers, you know, I heard about one multi-billion dollar company that actually they make people sign an NDA because one of the founders is so awkward socially that they try to hide that with a whole bunch of handlers, like it's Hollywood. And as a founder, especially as you're growing and you're building and you're laying out your foundation in a world where that foundation can be laid until you're 100 million revenue, quite honestly, you know, depending on the industry, you really, you know, if you don't have the option to have a marketing agency to give you like fireworks and, you know, billboards and pizzazz, then if it is authenticity, then I feel like the more you can demonstrate what's really going on, what is taking up your day, what is making you authentic, I guess, you know, that's the successes, the failures, take responsibility for the failures. I think that even though there are some marketing folks that say that, you know, hide the failures, only show positive, nothing but positive, sugar, 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 you know, like, and it always seems to me that, you know, having that transparency in what you're building, what you're doing, your struggles, how long, how hard things are to get off the ground and get things going. For me, that I think that has gotten me all of my sales. You know, I think. I don't think anyone who's buying from Cyber Crucible at this stage and probably for the first 100 million, you know, I don't think any of them really are buying because we have like the flashiest like NASCAR, you know, or anything like that. That's a different crowd buying for different reasons, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it goes back to people want to know about you. And this is why I love, you know, meeting people like you, Dennis, because the authenticity comes out, you're sharing. It's not, everyone just wants to share, like you say, the sugar. But sometimes when you share the challenges, you become humane. You become human. You become somebody that I can talk to, somebody I want to work with potentially, rather just the glitz and the glamour that's always out there. And I think especially within the tech world, there's so much of this, what I call puffing off the chest, you know, that look at the peacocking, because there is a degree of, you know, imposter syndrome within the industry. There's quite a lot of it. So this puffing of the chest thing really comes out. But if without the authenticity, it dies very, really quickly. And that's where the challenges are. So looking ahead, what are your revenue or impact goals for the next 12 to 20 more months? You're obviously on a great cadence now. You're heading in the right direction. What are the big revenue and impact goals that you're looking for, and what needs to happen in order you to hit?
Yeah. So, you know, we landed about $2 million last year in gross sales, which is phenomenal. Did it without requiring heavy founder dilution from a VC round or anything like that, which is also great. Early stage angels and founders, of course, love the, you know, the low dilution, right? That's a problem that plagues. I always joke, like, you know, they always have like that never ask. And I always feel like the founder that last should be never ask the founder the dilution, you know, that from the previous round, you know. But in terms of coming up next, we're in an interesting time where I built the product company without a bench, with very low burn rate in terms of salaries, you know, in terms of the team, contracted out pieces whenever we can to keep things very tight and keep burn low. And what's happening is now we're entering the growth phase, right? And so because I haven't said, okay, well, I have a spare $10 million, let me go ahead and grab a whole bunch of salespeople and see what happens, right? You know, I've been going through the, I always call it the hazing of channel partners, where you start with whoever will listen to you, you know, and maybe sell something. There's probably a lot of screwiness to their deals, you know, like where, the, you know, they're, that's their world, you know? And then you start getting bigger and more mature partners who don't really have time to try to, you know, like, hit you up over that $5, you know, that you just paid for coffee or whatever. You know, like, and so so as we're growing, we're getting money, more partners that potentially have a lot more revenue coming in, and they are adding a set of proposals. There's a lot more rigor to get through that process with them because they have their own company to run too, right? And from a sales perspective, it's a little bit challenging for me because I'm moving more, you know, where it was maybe 80% direct sales, and maybe some of these partners were bringing on some sales. And that's almost flip-flopping to where, you know, a partner promised, you know, like one partner came on and he said, hey, we're going to do like about $900,000 the first year. And I'm like, that's great. And if they don't, what do? You can't fire their salespeople if they don't perform, right? You can fire the partner, but what, you know, is what's that going to do for you? That doesn't make me money anyway, you know, like, and so it's turning from almost, you know, where I have direct control over the relationship with the customer to now giving up some of that control and then trying to enable them without having that direct control. And that for me, honestly, you know, back to that transparency, that's a scary place to be. You know, it's almost like being back in a government employee where you couldn't really fire the person because of government, you know, like, but you have to try to convince them to do their job, you know, and be successful, right? And yeah. It's a little bit like the military there, you know?
Yeah. I'll tell you, you've got some interesting times coming up, Dennis, you know, and I'm sure you're going to battle through them. But as you say, working with partnerships, great way to grow a company, but you do give up some of that control, and unless, you know, you go in there and you say, right, this is how we do things, and then you almost implement a training session in there to make sure that they're getting it right the way you would necessarily do it. But that's always going to be hallowed ground to step on, especially with new partners coming in. So if you had to give one piece of advice, Dennis, I can't believe time has gone ahead of us now, but if you had given one piece of advice to other tech leaders who are fighting to stand out today, what would it be?
Yeah, you know, it would be that you need to start today to plan for success at some point in the future. For me, that meant going from a former NSA operative kind of like LinkedIn profile that had like 3 followers, you know, and I realized that I did the math and I said, okay, well, I kept delaying starting, right? And then, because I'm like, oh, that's a surmount, there must be a shortcut, you know, there's no shortcut, just stop looking, stop paying, whatever, you know, start today and build incrementally, you know, and by doing that, you will get to where you need to be. Like, I promise you will get there. But it just takes a daily, a daily exercise and rigor to don't look at today's success, just do the next step, you know, and just keep on going. And that's where you look back and realize you surpassed your success metric because you weren't focused on it. You were just focused on delivering every day.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that what a great piece of advice and insight to end on, because, you know, I would go as far to say, if you took all the cybersecurity out there, I would say there's still about 30 to 40% of cybersecurity on LinkedIn still have the LinkedIn black background.
Nice.
You're not going to stand out. You can't even put your own banner up there, right? What you actually do. It's absolutely great. So as you say, you can't do the NSA stuff anymore. You've got to go. You can't be the best kept secret. You've got to go out there and you've got to start saying, hey, listen to me. I've got something really important for you to share that I want to get across to you that will really help you. So Dennis, listen, it's been absolutely fantastic having you here today. If people want to get to know you a little bit more, potentially work with you, what's the best way of doing that?
You know, I feel like we're on a LinkedIn commercial here, but find me on LinkedIn. I'm always there. There's only 2 Dennis Underwoods. One is a pharmacy tech, like a geneticist type person, and there's me, the cyber person, you know. So Both remarkably handsome men, though. You know, so.
So well, I'll make sure that your proper link is actually in the show notes, so they can just do a one click and get hold of you. Well, Dennis, thank you very much for joining us today. I think your insights have been absolutely fantastic. You've certainly kept me going, and obviously we've just, you know, the time just comes above us. We should definitely, I think, as I said, perhaps you and I should do a part two, because there's so much more we could
reverse discuss. It where I ask you questions. I mean, I'd love to do that.
Well, thanks again, Dennis. It's been absolutely fantastic.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Not at all. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us for yet another episode of the Growth Focus podcast. And by now, you know what I'm going to say. If you have picked up anything from Dennis today, please make sure you like it and make sure you take it, put it in the comments so that other people can see what you've picked up from Dennis, you know, the insights from there. But more importantly, please make sure you share. This is how we grow. We grow by standing on the shoulders of giants like Dennis and the others. And the more you share, the more everybody grows. So until next time, keep striving, keep working hard, but more importantly, please make sure you're profitable, and we'll see you on the next episode. Bye-bye.